PHP is everywhere these days. I'm sure you've seen it when you're browsing around the web. You see PHP everywhere. And it's gotten a bit of a bad reputation in some circles, especially with the more technical folks or the harder core programmers tend to really not like PHP very much. The problem is we're not quite sure which PHP they don't like. There are a lot of different PHPs, and they're different in the sense of how people use PHP. I've listed sort of the five main ways that I see PHP used out in the world. My favorite way, and not the way I use it, or I sort of encourage anybody else to use it, but it's almost become the basic of the web in the sense that when you buy a computer these days, there's no programming language on it. When I bought my first computer in 1981, I think, you turn it on and you have a prompt. At that prompt, you can start programming. Right? 10 print hello, 20 go to 10. Run. Right? It ran. And that was pretty much all a 1981 computer could do. So all I could do with it, sit at home and play with it and program it, basically. There were a few games here and there, but how much of a game can you fit in 1K of memory? Right? So you play with it for 5 minutes, then you start taking it apart and to figure out how it works. And that's how I learned how to program. Not that I'm a very good programmer, but the device came and that was all it really did. Today, when a kid gets a Windows box, give him a Pentium Windows XP box. The first thing he does is not start to program it because it's gotten way too complex. I don't know how to program a Windows XP box either. I mean, this stuff is really, really complex these days, and it's daunting, and the tools aren't even there. Your average kid is not going to go out and buy a Visual C++ and start hacking away. I think the web is simple enough. And that is sort of the replacement today for the early 80s computers that my generation started learning to program on. I think the web is that to today's kids. Because HTTP is a relatively simple protocol. It's text-based, simple request-response. You send one request, you get one response back. There's no real relationship between one request to the next, so it's really damn simple. And PHP has been slotted in sort of as the very easy to start with and easy to use programming language to program the web. So that's the first use I see. I see a lot of kids, and I get a lot of email from kids who are working on school projects or are working on their parents' website or something. And sometimes they tell me how old they are. After a while, I figure it out, but I've gotten kids that are 9, 10 years old that are asking me somewhat complex PHP questions, and I think that's really cool. Now, the use that I intended when I started this was as a templating system. Basically, the front end to take whatever back end data and logic that you need to expose to the web. That was what PHP was for. Initially, there were no conditionals in PHP, there were no tags like if, else, things like that. It was simply a macro templating system in the sense that you could put a special tag into your HTML, and the HTML, when displayed through the web browser, would then have those tags replaced with whatever those tags translated to. That's been lost a little bit over the years. As the templating language grew, and after you hit, basically after you add the first if tag to a templating system like this, you've pretty much lost. You can't stop. All right? But I'll talk a bit more about that in a second. There are also people that use this as a general purpose scripting language for anything. And the logic is usually, well, why should I learn two languages? I already know PHP for web stuff. Let me write my shell scripts and cron jobs and things in PHP. There's nothing really wrong with that, but it's not really the intended purpose of PHP. There are better tools out there for it. Perl and Awk are ones that I usually use for all my shell scripting. There are also people that use PHP as sort of an overall framework for everything. They have all their business logic written in PHP. They have huge monstrosity frameworks that everything sort of fits into, and they will sort of push that framework as a way of solving a specific class of web problems. That tends to be okay as well, as long as your web problem happens to fit into that class that they have intended, and that you like the flow, the process flow through their framework. I find it takes me a lot longer to learn one of these frameworks than it would to me just sit down and write it myself. So I'm not a big proponent of large frameworks, and frameworks tend to have a lot of layers, and they have a lot of abstraction layers, indirection layers, and I really hate layers. And last, and I have a question mark on this one because I don't really think it applies, but some people are really pushing towards becoming sort of a full application server, whatever that means. PHP could easily be a component of an application server, but in and of itself, PHP is nowhere near an application server. PHP is basically sort of a web templating system on steroids. It can do anything you can imagine. So, what I'll talk most about today is the templating approach, because that was sort of how I saw PHP, that's how I still see PHP, that's how I use PHP in my day job. And basically, it's just a way of separating your logic from your layout. And it's kind of interesting, because that's one of the major criticisms that people have, that PHP sort of mushes together HTML and code all in the same file. And they say, well, this is so dirty, this is so messy. PHP allows you to do that. PHP doesn't require you to make a mess of things. I have never been very interested in tools that enforced a certain way of approaching a problem. I mean, PHP, in a certain sense, enforces a way of solving problems, but not in a sort of stylistic sense. If you want to stick everything in a single file and put your HTML and your business logic and everything in one file, great. PHP will let you do that. And I do that all the time. You want to hack up a quick page that does something? 20 minutes later, you have a working little web application that does exactly what you want. And yeah, it's not pretty, but maybe it doesn't need to be. Maybe it only needs to survive for a day, and then you throw it away. So it's nice that the tool allows you to be messy and allows you to hack. What defines a templating system is that line, that very tricky line between your logic and your layout. Where you define the intersection line really defines how the templating system works. Every templating system out there, at least for the web, has to have that intersection between your business logic and your HTML, because what goes across the wire is a jumble of the result of your business logic with the HTML layout applied to it, and it goes out as a single stream of bytes. So at some point, these two things have to come together. I've heard lots of arguments from people about the perfect separation of the two. There's no such thing. You cannot perfectly separate them because they have to touch at some point. And it's all about how you define that meeting point. PHP doesn't really define that. PHP lets you define it yourself in a certain sense. And in about an hour, I guess, I will go through the architecture that I have been trying to push on people, because I realized after a while that nobody really understood how to build a large-scale PHP application. I look around at the existing applications that are out there, and most of them are a mess. And some of the criticism PHP has taken for that is warranted, because we never really sort of steered people in the right direction. We just provided the tool and sort of let it loose. And I want to try to steer people a little bit, saying, okay, if you are going to build something large scale, if you do have 100 developers working on something, here's a mechanism that you can use. And my last point is that any templating system will eventually become PHP. There are templating systems for PHP. There's a popular one called Smarty. which layers templating on top of PHP to sort of define that boundary between business logic and layout. And they've chosen to do that by putting another templating system on top of it. But things are starting to creep into their templating system. They have if, else type logic in there. They're starting to have arrays and object orientation is sneaking in there. You can write some pretty complex business logic in their templating language. Pretty soon, they will become PHP themselves. And then it doesn't make any sense, because what are they templating away here? So I would strongly encourage you to try to do templating with PHP itself, instead of layering anything on top. Templating with PHP is all about a little bit of discipline and sticking to your rules. Define where you want to put stuff and sticking to that. But we'll talk more about that. Some numbers. Netcraft in the UK every month pokes all the servers it knows about on the web. Here in January, they poked 46 million domains. So these are unique domains, not necessarily servers. The server can host many domains, obviously. So these are 46 million unique domains that they poked. And 14.7 or so million of those are running PHP. So about a third of all the domains out there have PHP on them. It's hard to tell whether they use PHP or not, but at least the server that they're on has PHP installed. And this only catches the Apache module version of PHP. There's a lot of ISPs that have the CGI version there, and there are a lot of non-Apache servers these days as well that have PHP support, and we can't detect those. There are also companies like the one I work for that turn off the fact that there's a little exposed PHP switch in the PHP configuration file. You can set to off, and then there's no way anybody from the outside can know that you're using PHP. You can make .html your PHP extension, you could turn off exposed PHP, and nobody will know that you're using it. And plenty of companies do that as well. We obviously don't get those numbers either. From the Apache module perspective, PHP is by far the most popular Apache module. There's another company called Security Space that pokes only Apache servers and sees which modules are installed. They poked 9.2 million Apache servers and found 5 million of those with PHP installed on them. 54% of all the Apache servers out there. This is one of the things that's holding up Apache 2. And if anybody's interested, I can go on my whole Apache 2 tirade at some point. If I run out of stuff, I'll kick into that. One of the reasons PHP is so heavily used are some of the killer apps, I call them. I'm going to show you just a couple of examples of them. There's Gallery, which is available here at gallery.monalto.com. Gallery is a photo album management software type thing. So here I have an album full of baby pictures, 2,183 baby pictures online. And it's sort of a hierarchical thing where you can have top-level albums, you can have sub-albums. So my Australia trip this time around is here on the conferences sub-album, where I have pictures from earlier today, trade tracking away and stuff. So anyway, this, and it's skinnable and themable and stuff, and it's very, very easy to install and get up and running. A lot of people use Gallery out there. Squirrel Mail, basically your standard webmail type application. I have that sitting on my home server. So you can go, you can log in, and you can read your mail. I think I made a test account just for this purpose, didn't I? Maybe I didn't. I don't really want to log into my own mailbox, because it's... Maybe it was guest. Nah, doesn't matter. You've probably seen Squirrel Mail out there. A lot of ISPs use Squirrel Mail for their particular webmail. FUD Forum is a forum-type application that's really good. There are a lot of them out there. They started sort of with PHP Nuke, and then there's one called PHP BB for bulletin board. There's a commercial one called VBulletin. It's probably a couple of dozen bulletin board software packages out there. If you're looking for one of these sort of discussion board type packages, I would take a serious look at FUD Forum. It's the only one that I've looked through and not cringed from a security perspective when I was looking at the code. Some of the other ones have more features, true. But I know Ilya, who wrote this, he's very security conscious, and looking through his code, you're not going to get hacked as fast as you will if you install something like PHP Nuke or PHP BB. I guarantee you, you will be hacked within 24 hours if you install one of those other two. At least if anybody knows about your server. I mean, don't connect it to the internet, you're probably okay, unless somebody in your family hacks it, because it's really not hard to do. So another one I use, Serendipity. I hate blogs with a passion, but I do have a toys page. And I hate blogs because it's our interface to the web these days is basically Google's PageRank, and blogs have completely destroyed Google's PageRank because we have all these morons basically linking to each other. So the PageRank for somebody's personal blog, who's a 12-year-old kid that doesn't know anything about a certain topic, but he links with all his friends on that topic, and you go and look for that topic, and all you see are a bunch of kids talking about it. You don't see the actual page that's definitive on it. So I don't like blogs for the reason. I don't mind people sort of sharing information and stuff, but because of the cross-linking that all blogs do, it's completely destroyed searching the web these days, which isn't really blog's fault. It's PageRank's fault. We need to fix PageRank, but until we do, we have a problem. Anyway, this is Serendipity. It's this blogging package that I just use to keep track of the toys that I play with. So whenever I get a new toy, I tend to sort of sit down and hack it to death and figure out how it works. I bought this thing called a Linksys Media Appliance that you hook up to your TV and you have a remote control where you can look at pictures and listen to MP3s and stuff. And it has a wireless connection, so you just sort of stick it by your TV and it connects to your existing wireless network. And it's kind of cool. But it only speaks to a Windows server and stuff, so I was hacking away at the protocol. But anyway, so I use this Serendipity package to do stuff like this. And it's pretty cool. You completely manage all your entries via a management interface. So here I can go in, I can say edit an entry, for example, and it lists all the various entries. So if I want to go in and edit one of them, you can go in, and then you see the sort of the raw HTML, and you can get a preview then. If you modify something, you get a preview of what it would look like when it renders. So it's a nice little package. And it does RDF and all kinds of stuff as well. And the last one I use is Cacti. Cacti is an RRDF front end. So Cacti plus RRDF is sort of like MRTG on steroids. For any sysadmin types in here, you'll know what MRTG is. And what I use it for is to keep track of my server. It would be good if I can remember my password. Damn it. No, I'm going to use that. I think it's admin, actually. What's my username instead? Ah, there we go. So, let me do the overview thing. So this thing, you basically, through Cacti, you can define all sorts of rules and all sorts of data collection mechanisms. So here I'm keeping track of the disk space on my server, for example. And that doesn't change, so it's kind of a boring stat to keep track of. Logged in users over the past 24 hours, so at some point there were 3 users logged in. My load average, not sure what happened around here, but obviously there was something burning the CPU. Memory usage, ping latency to Yahoo. Send mail statistics, green is inbound, and yellow or orange is outbound, and red is spam, stuff that was bounced. And then SMTP, traffic on the actual NIC, if you zoom in on one of them, you can see the 24-hour stuff, then you can go down to the weekly, monthly, and then finally the yearly. I've only had this up for about a month, so there's not much there. But it's a very nice, I mean, you can do most of the stuff with MRTG and some other stuff, but RRD tool is a very nice way of handling it because it has the circular buffer stuff. And with this PHP interface on top of it, it's just basically you click your way through to finding all these various server monitoring systems. And it's pretty easy to do. There's a console and the whole admin interface where you can go through and add data input methods and polling hosts and stuff. So it's a very nice application. I was always too lazy to set up sort of an end-to-end monitoring system because it's a lot of work. With Cacti, it's really not that hard. You sort of install it, plug it in, and click a few times, and you have a nice system for monitoring your machine. All right, so those were a couple of killer apps. There are a bunch of other ones out there. These are just the ones I happen to use. So, PHP itself, for those of you, and there are a few people that asked me beforehand if you're required to know anything about PHP to understand stuff. So, no, not really, but I'm going to ramp up pretty fast. But we'll start really basic. PHP is a templating system, and the language lives inside an HTML file. So a request comes in to a web server for a certain file. The web server will identify that request as being a PHP request, hand off to PHP, give the file descriptor basically to PHP. PHP will read in the file, pass over it once, convert everything to a set of opcodes, and then execute those opcodes. So it'll pass over the HTML. It sort of ignores any HTML bits, sees a PHP bit, and executes this PHP bit, basically. So it's the result of this line of PHP that shows up in the resulting file. So what gets sent back out is this file with the PHP tags evaluated or resolved into whatever they evaluate to, and the result goes over the wire. A lot of people are always asking me, hey, I do a view source in my browser, I don't see my PHP. My JavaScript that's right next to it, I see, but I don't see my PHP. That's because PHP is server-side and JavaScript is client-side. They're both in the HTML file, but one gets evaluated on the server, and then the result is sent out, whereas the other one gets sent to the client and evaluated there. There are four ways to embed PHP in an HTML file. The initial way I had was the short tag style, we call it now, bracket question mark, PHP, question mark, bracket. The longer tag style, this is mostly because this tag style can conflict with XML. You know how you can have bracket question mark XML in your document? If you are mixing XML tags in there as well, you should use the longer tag style. We can do ASP style tags, bracket, percent. You can turn that off on in your PHP configuration file called phpini. The directive is called ASP underscore tags. You just turn that on. You can use ASP tags if you like. And then also finally, script language equals PHP if you really like to type a lot. Go. Okay. I'm just going to show you a couple of nifty things. I used to show a lot more nifty things in this talk, but a lot of other sort of more important things has crept in. But I wrote an extension very recently, 2 months ago or so, called GDChart. There's a library out there called libgdchart, which sits on top of this graphing library called libgd. It's not really a very good library, neither GD nor libgdchart. They're not very good, but they're really simple to use, and they're very simple to wrap. And what I did was I wrote a GDChart extension. So you can now create graphs that are generated in C, basically. The entire thing, the extension is written in C, and the PHP component to generate this graph here, is only these 8 lines or so. First thing you do, say, hey, here comes some image PNG content. So the important thing to see here, first of all, is that PHP isn't used to just generate HTML. You can also spew out images with PHP. Any request that comes to your web server, the web server is going to do something and send the result back. If the request comes in for an image, it doesn't have to be a static image sitting on your hard drive. You can have PHP generate that image data. And that's what I'm doing here. But I have to tell it what type of data my PHP script is going to be generating. So this script would be called from an image source tag. So you would have img space source equals foo.php. And you would put that in your HTML file. When the browser gets to that tag, it's going to send a request for foo.php expecting an image. Foo.php says, here comes a PNG image. New GD chart. This happens to be a line chart. I add a couple of data sets. So you use this add method on the chart object. And you just have all your data in an array, basically. That array could have been read in from a database or from some other external source. Here I'm just hard coding the array directly. So I add in three data sets, my three lines, basically. I add in some labels. There's a labels property that you can set to an array of labels. And I add three colors. And it's just going to say first data set, first color, second data set, second color. And then I tell it, spit out the graph of type PNG, 640 by 480 is the size. And that's what you get out. Obviously, it made a lot of decisions on its own. It figured out that it shouldn't start at zero because there was no data anywhere near zero, so it moved the labels around a little bit. It arbitrarily chose a scale vertically to make it fit nicely. So all kinds of things were sort of magically figured out. If you don't like some of these magical decisions, you can change them. So you can go through and say, for example, requested y min. This is a property you can set 0, meaning I would like it to start at 0, even though there's no data down there. Label density. I thought there were too many labels on my axis here. I only want 25% of them. And the label format, I didn't like the fractions that it decided to use, so I can tell it to use decimals instead. So here's my new one that starts at 0 and has only a quarter of the labels going up. So there's not very much programming, so just throw some quick charts up with this. There are PHP packages that do the same thing. The reason I wrote this was that some folks at Yahoo were asking me, hey, we're trying to generate graphs, but you guys all know Yahoo and the amount of traffic we get, we cannot spend a second generating a graph. It has to be done in under 150 milliseconds, basically. Nothing can take more than 150 milliseconds, or it just doesn't scale big enough for Yahoo. So I had to write this stuff all in C. So that's the difference between GDChart and everything else that you might use in PHP to generate graphs, is that this stuff is all written in C. All you're doing is throwing the data into C, and C is going to chew on it and spit out a graph directly. So other things you can do, 3D area chart can be done with it. Obviously, I changed the background color and stuff here. You can do fancy pie charts. We can explode out slices and stuff. So here's a fancy pie chart. I also tossed in some TrueType fonts on this one. And you can see that's why it got a little bit complex. Oops. The code for it here, I go through and I set the point size. I define a TrueType font, I set the point size, and another TrueType font. And there's an explode property somewhere where you can go through and you can say the explode distance from the center. So every slice that's zero is not exploded. It's sitting right in the, touching the middle. The second slice, basically, I've exploded out 40 pixels. Pi depth, perspective, pi angle. So you can sort of rotate your chart as well. And the last one is a high-low close type chart. Think stock prices. So you would then show sort of throughout a year the high, the low, and the closing price in the middle, and you can then add some events to it and stuff. So that's the last. And this is also a combination chart where you can put two charts. You have one sort of in behind and another one on front. And this was done with it's called a combo HLC area 3D. And I didn't make up all these various graph types and stuff. It all comes from the backend library. I basically just wrapped it and put a nice object-oriented interface on top of it, so it's easy to use. And this is the same idea you would use if you're doing any sort of high-end PHP work. Chances are the really heavy lifting is not going to be done in PHP. the really heavy lifting is going to be done in a strongly typed language where you've written something, or maybe it's already there, where you have some back-end library that does the real work. What you will do in PHP is write a front-end extension that wraps it nicely, and then you basically expose this extension or this PHP API to your web development team. If you are the web development person, well then, that's you as well, and off you go. So other things you can do, I'm not going to talk much about PDF. I did a whole thing on PDF last year in Perth. You can also generate PDFs from PHP. What did I do? Did I break my PDF example? I did break my PDF example. Dang. How did I do that? Okay. Well, I probably can't fix it right now unless I have voice. No, I don't. I swear it was working this morning. Did I change my air level? Hey, no snoring. I know I'm boring, but damn it. Let's try just one little trick here. You're lucky I don't have anything to throw. There was a guy once that fell asleep and I threw an eraser at him. Oh no, I didn't fix it. I don't know how I broke it. Anyway, just like you can generate images on the fly, you can also generate PDF documents on the fly. And if my Firebird wasn't screwed up, because it really is generating a PDF document, and this is the PDF document, for some reason my browser is not kicking up the Acrobat Reader right now. It's been a little bit flaky with that. But anyway, same as images, you can go through and you can draw lines, you can draw stuff, you can draw paragraphs of text, and you can basically build up a PDF document from the raw components and basically write a program that generates a PDF document. It's really hard to write a huge report or something in it, but what it's really useful for is as a template, like an invoice template where you have customer data in a database. They go through, they buy something from your website, and you generate an invoice. And you pull out the price of the objects and stuff, and you put their name and their address on it, and everything else in the invoice is already there, basically. So you just have to pass in a couple of arguments to your invoice drawing function, and it can generate the invoice. And you can, in the customer's profile, they could pick their paper size, for example. So you generate this invoice that's specifically geared for whatever paper they happen to have in their printer or whatever else they might choose to want on there. And the idea being that PDFs are printable. Web pages are not printable. You never really know where things are going to go on the printed piece of paper. With a PDF, you can do lots of interesting things. You can put barcodes in the right places and stuff, but the final result will always look the same. So that's the big draw for doing PDF. And it's very nice to be able to dynamically generate these things on the fly. Let me turn my errors back on, because I'm going to need that in a little bit. Sorry? Does PHP itself need a MIME type? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Did I lose my MIME type? I did move it because, yeah. Where's my display errors? Hold on, sorry. I need these on to show you something else in a little bit. But maybe you're right. Maybe I did lose my MIME type. Let's see. Let's see if we can fix it quickly. Slides. Intro. You can also see my slide format now. Mm-hmm. I do. It's there. It doesn't have to be at the top, right? You only have to send the, before you send any output, you have to make sure that it's the first thing that gets sent out. All this stuff up here is just generating a PDF in memory, right? So I'm building up my PDF document in memory, and then just before sending it, I get the data out of the PDF buffer, right? I send my content type. I set content disposition inline. This is supposed to tell the browser, hey, here's an inline PDF document, please display it. And it normally works. I bet if I restarted my Mozilla, it would actually work. But I'm not going to do that. And file name equals invoice.pdf. This is mainly for IE. So when someone goes to save the PDF document, it'll be called invoice.pf. Even though my script is not called invoice.pdf. If you don't put this in, it'll be the name of the script that generated it. And finally, I send the content length, because IE as well doesn't like a PDF document that doesn't have a content length associated with it. Or it goes all haywire on you. Other nasty things you can do? Oh, man. Okay. Actually, I know what I can fix this. Well, it's... now, blah, 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 blah. Oh. Aha, here we go. A little bit of quick hacking. I had to change the style a little bit to generate my PDF. I have this automatic presentation system that you see here that takes an XML file and generates all my slides. So it's a big PHP program that reads these XML files and generates content in different formats. The ones you're seeing are the HTML generated ones, but I also have a PDF mode where it just spits out a big PDF file. So, let's see, if I put equals, and I somehow I broke it when I inline these scripts for some reason. But I bet if I put it here and we go back, I can feel it's working. It takes a while to start up Adobe Acrobat in the background if it's not already running, so that's why it's taking a while to display the slide. Uh-huh. All right, I fixed it. Redraw. So anyway, so this is the generated invoice. So that's the generated invoice, and there's really nothing really to see here other than the fact that the code prints out this invoice looking thing with gray and white alternating stripes and stuff. And then what you pass into this routine that draws the invoice is just an array of all the items, and then the code automatically fills it all in. And the one cool thing I have is a bug. And it's a cool bug because at the very bottom here, I'm off by one in my alternating colors, and there's this funny off-colored one at the bottom. And I think it's cool because I've seen this on at least three e-commerce sites that have PDF invoices. So you go and you look at your invoice and go, wow, that looks exactly like my bug. Go figure. So let me just apply the same fix to my Flash stuff. XML. Sorry about that. Okay. Basically, what I'm doing, I was inlining my code to do the proper printout for the PDF version that I put online. But for some reason, my inlined ones are not executing correctly right now. It's a bug I'll have to fix. Okay. Yay. Okay. So this was a generated Flash animation, basically. So, I mean, this is real Flash. You can zoom in, you can move it around, and there's no Macromedia tools involved in this, right? It's just straight PHP via Ming, which is a cool library. And again, I didn't write Ming. I don't know anything about Flash. And I didn't write the extension even. Someone else wrote the extension. But this is taking the back-end Flash generation library, sticking a nice, quick little PHP front-end on it, and you can do some really cool things with this. There's even a translator, so you can generate a Flash animation using one of Macromedia's tools. Then you can do an SWF to PHP conversion. It will take the Flash and convert it to a bunch of PHP calls. It's not perfect, doesn't get everything right, but it's kind of cool that you can use the graphical tool that then generates the PHP code for you. Then you can go in and hack the PHP code. So instead of being sort of a static Flash animation, and static in the sense, not in the sense it doesn't move around, because Flash is always going everywhere, but it can be dynamic in the sense that every time you load it up, it can go and talk to a database, for example. So you can do an SQL query in the middle of your Flash to put up messages or something. There are a couple of kids in India that are building an RPG-type game where every room is a new Flash animation, and they have a database behind the scenes where they keep track of which objects are in which rooms. When you go from one room to the next, you get a new Flash animation with the right objects and stuff. And now with ActionScript in Flash 6, these things can be done in the middle of the animation. So, I mean, even if the animation is already loaded and running, if someone enters the room, he'll pop up on your Flash animation there, because ActionScript is actually a pretty cool scripting language that sits inside of Flash that can be integrated with PHP as well. And you can do some really, really fancy things. Stuff that you would never expect to see on the web can be done with a combination of PHP, Flash, and ActionScript. I don't have the patience to work on it myself. This is about the limit of my ability with Flash, is to make a spinning logo. All right. So those were three examples of sort of weird stuff, weird and interesting things that you can do with PHP. We also have something called Pear, which is a repository of PHP-level code, so user-space PHP code that people have written and put up. And you can go to Pear, P-E-A-R, .php.net to learn more about it. There's also a Pear tool. It's the Pear installer, so you can do Pear list. You can get a list of all your installed packages. It's sort of like RPM or apt-get, if you will, for PHP, but it's called Pear. You can see what's available on the Pear server remotely, so you can do Pear remote list. You see all the various classes and pieces of software that's available. And this is a very old list. There are hundreds more these days. You can get a list of things that should be upgraded or that it's suggesting that you upgrade. So this is a package that's installed on my server, but there's a newer version available from Pear. So then you can do Pear upgrade, and it's going to pull down the latest one, and off you go, or just Pear install the thing that you want to install. So it's a pretty neat little tool to install things, and we're trying to push more things to be Pear installable. Like that list of killer apps that I showed you before, it'd be very nice if you just type Pear install gallery, and it goes and it installs everything. And quite a few things now can use the Pear installer, and not just PHP user space applications. We're also using it for something called Pekkle, which is the PHP extension code library. There's a picture of a very snowy landscape here, because a lot of people, we're threatening to push all extensions into Pekkle. We've gotten to the point where PHP has gotten too big. There are way too many extensions, and we can't manage it all. Every time we need to do a release, we sort of have to poke all the extension authors, saying, hey, are you ready to do a release now? And there are so many of them that it's very, very hard to get everyone on the same track. So what we really want to do is push most of the extensions out into Pekkle so they're installable separately. But people are afraid, people who currently have their extension bundled with PHP are afraid that if it becomes unbundled, then a lot fewer people will use it, and that's uncool. And in a sense, they're probably right, but it also means that they can use their own release schedule. And it's just easier and more scalable to do it like this, but that's why I have the snowy landscape here, because it's been nicknamed Siberia for PHP extensions, that if you get stuck into Pekkle, it's like getting stuck in Siberia. There's just no way home from there. You can use Pear to install extensions or Peckle extensions. You can even use Pear to install things that are not necessarily in Peckle, but they have the, there's a little package.xml file that it's almost like a Red Hat spec file to build an RPM. So if a tarball that contains a PHP extension has a package.xml in it, you can just install it directly. So you can do pair install, then the URL to the tarball. Here's one called xdebug, which is a debugging extension, which I'll show you later on, for PHP. That can be installed directly by doing pair install, the URL to the tarball, and it's going to download the tarball, untar it, uncompress it, untar it. Since it's a C-level extension, it's going to compile it. I sort of skipped all the lines for compiling. You actually see a whole bunch of stuff, but 28 source files, building, running PHP IDEs, blah, 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 blah. So there's the make, it compiled, and then it built a shared library that it then installed, and it's ready to go. And now that should now be available. So it's not just PHP level stuff, it's also the C level stuff. And it's becoming really easy to extend PHP in terms of both with PHP and with C or C++. All right. Another thing that people use a lot with PHP is MySQL. So I'm going to go through a very quick overview of PHP interacting with MySQL. There was a Postgres talk today, so I'm not going to talk about Postgres. I actually use both, and I also use another one we'll talk about in a little bit. So the first thing, if you need MySQL and PHP talking to each other, chances are you probably already have MySQL support installed in PHP. Even if you don't have MySQL, the server installed, you probably have the client. You can check by putting a little PHP info script together. Just put this in the file, name the file whatever you want, info.php perhaps, and then load up info.php. You'll see something like this. There's pages and pages of it, but part of it is going to be this MySQL section. And if you see this MySQL section, it means you have MySQL support in PHP. And you can check the version number and stuff. If it isn't there, that means you need to install it. If you're on a Debian system and you don't see it, that's because you haven't installed the PHP MySQL package. You can just install that. There's a similar package for Red Hat. If you're on a Windows server, there's a, in the tarball, or in the zip file, I guess, for Windows, in the zip file that you download from PHP, there is a mysql.dll. And you basically just have to uncomment it in the configuration file. So my file lives here, etc/php/ini. It wouldn't be there on the Windows box, obviously. But you'll see there's all these extension lines. I know the color is bad. Hold on. No, it's not in my list. Anyway, there are all those extension lines. And basically what you have to do is just uncomment the line for the extension that you want. So all these various things are all the features that are not enabled. So in your Windows setup, find your PHP INI file, go and uncomment the line that you want just by removing the semicolon, and restart your web server, and that extension will now be available on your Windows setup. If you're manually doing it, and the same thing applies basically on Unix or Linux, just make sure you have an extension equals mysql.so in your PHP INI file, and you should be good to go. You can set your extension directory if you want to sort of manage where it goes yourself. Set your extension directory, and then the mysql.so file will have to live in whatever directory you specify. So, to actually get stuff working, make sure that you can talk to your server. If it's on a different host, do mysql show minus h, the host name that it's on. Assuming it's on localhost, mysql show should tell you whether or not it's running. If it isn't running, start it. So that's from the command line. Now, from PHP, you can do a quick check just to see, hey, are we alive? You can call mysql stat. It's going to echo out the uptime, number of threads, slow queries, things like that. So that's just confirms that PHP and MySQL are talking to each other. Now, the most common error you'll see, let's break my setup here instead of fixing it for a change. The default socket. Sometimes PHP's client library doesn't always understand where the socket should be. Hold on. Let me type and then talk. So if you see an error like this, it says MySQL stat can't connect to local MySQL server through socket slash temp mysql.soc. Basically, when you're talking to MySQL on the local host, it goes through something called a Unix domain socket. A Unix domain socket is basically a file. And both ends, the server has to sit and listen to that, any messages coming to that file, and the client has to write to the right file. If the server is listening to one and the client's writing to another, they're not talking to each other. So both ends needs to know where that is. So in this case, my server thinks it should be in slash temp. No, sorry, PHP thinks it should be in slash temp, but my server has put it somewhere else. And when I initially tested my talk this morning, this was the slide that actually didn't work because I didn't have this in there. So in your MySQL or in your PHP on iFile, you can specify where the socket is. Step back up, reload the page, and then now sanity check works again. Connecting to MySQL is easy. MySQL connect, name of the server. You should have a password and a username as well. You don't have to. I've set it up so that the web user on my local host here can connect without a password. And I've also turned off connections from the outside. So it's reasonably secure, unless, of course, someone hacks into your server and then connects locally themselves. But if they can hack into their server, they can probably blow away the raw database files anyway. So it probably doesn't help much. So what you get back is a resource ID. Can't do much with that directly, but you pass that resource ID, or you sort of inherently use the resource ID to do other things from then on, like sending off queries. So there are some other formats. If you're connecting to a different server, different port with a username and a password, you can also specify the socket directly in your connect call if you don't want to configure it. And you can turn on SSL and compression and other fancy things. So here's a persistent connection. All you do differently is you put a pconnect in front of it. And a persistent connection means that after the request is done, the persistent connection will be left. So it's staying there. A normal MySQL connect will connect to the database, you do something in your script, then you disconnect. With a persistent connection, there's just no disconnect, basically. That means the next time in, pconnect checks to see, hey, it's already there, I don't have to make a new connection. So that makes it easier and faster in the sense that you don't have to establish new database connections on every single request. You have to watch out a little bit, though, because you have to sort of count up how many web server clients do I have. If you're using Apache, which is a multi-process web server, you're going to have a certain number, and that's set in your Apache configuration file, something called max client. It's the absolute max number of child processes that can be running at any one time. By default, that comes out of Apache as 150, if you haven't changed it. MySQL's default for the number of concurrent connections is 100. So you have to be a little bit careful, because if you underload, maybe through all your testing you never had more than 10 or 12 of these running, but then suddenly you get slashed on it, for example. All your clients end up starting up. You have 150 of them going, but only 100 of them are going to have a MySQL connection, because the other 50 is beyond the max concurrent connections. So just make sure those two numbers are in sync. And make sure you have one spare one for yourself for administrating the thing so you can shut it down and start it up and stuff. Don't set both to 100. Set the max connections from MySQL to 101, maybe, and have max clients set to 100. So then your web server gets 100, you get one for administering it remotely. Creating a database, you would normally do that directly. Using the MySQL command line tool, probably, but you can also do it from within PHP. It's just a query like any other. So here I created a database called foo. Creating a table, you can also do just by sending a query. Inserting data, again, it's just a query. So here I go through, I connect to the database, select the database to use, call this add user function. So add user is a function I defined up here that does an insert with the arguments that I'm passing to the function. So it's actually really easy and straightforward. There isn't much to it. The PHP interface to MySQL is very light. All you're really doing is sort of taking queries from the web interface and shoving them into MySQL, and off you go. Yes. Right, okay. So the question is, what about security on this? There are a few things that we do to try to make sure this is reasonably secure. You'll see, I mean, I'm not doing a MySQL query variable name. I mean, they're not inserting the entire query. The one thing you have to watch out for is that can they somehow escape out of the current query and then inject their own SQL? One thing we do, we automatically escape any quotes, single quotes and doubles quotes and backslashes, and everything is automatically escaped by PHP. So if someone types in foo, single quote, semicolon, whatever, and then tries to do a delete from a database, that single quote is going to get escaped. So that entire query is going to be part of that one string argument, and it's just going to get shoved in as a string argument. It's not going to be able to escape out of that query. You can turn off, that's something called magic quotes. It's actually, you're two slides ahead of me, but you can turn off magic quotes, and then you have to do that yourself. And you have to check all the input for that. But yes, by default, PHP will prevent SQL injection like that. Selecting data, same thing. Send off a MySQL query, select star from users, and then we have these various fetch functions. So we have one called MySQL fetch row, which just fetches it and gives you back a row of data in an array, a numerical array. You can then walk through it and print out each one. There's one called fetch array that gets you the result in an associative array. So you can, the index in the array is the name of the column that the data was associated with. So row ID, row password, row name, things like that. Dealing with timestamps, just not that much to it. Basically, a lot of people are always asking me about converting back and forth from one timestamp to, from like Unix timestamps that PHP tends to use versus MySQL timestamps. MySQL has all the functionality in there. There's a date format function in MySQL itself that can pull out a timestamp in any format you want. And same thing for inserting stuff. You can basically insert stuff in any format you want, and you can pull it out in any format you want. So don't try to do too much timestamp manipulation on the PHP side. Let the database do it. It's really fast in MySQL to do date manipulation in there. There's an update query, obviously. There's also a MySQL unique one called replace into, which basically will update if the row is already there, or insert if it isn't. An update will only change an existing row. Replace into can be used to replace sort of the select if it's there, update, otherwise insert. That entire logic can be replaced with a replace into. Magic quotes, I already went through, but that was the slide on that. Squid. Doesn't seem very related to PHP or MySQL, for example, but it's really cool. And it's actually not just Squid. It's the idea of a reverse proxy cache in front of your web server. That's very, very interesting. It can solve a lot of problems. A reverse proxy works just like a proxy does, but you just sort of turn the picture upside down. It's probably easier to explain a proxy cache first. Your ISP, especially here in Australia, probably every ISP uses some kind of proxy cache. Meaning when you go and browse some website somewhere, go to CNN.com, you're going to pull down the content from CNN.com. Your ISP is going to stick that in the proxy cache and say, okay, I'm going to cache this for a little while. So when the next guy requests CNN.com a second later, the ISP doesn't have to go to the US to fetch the content. It can just fetch it from its cache directly. And there's all kinds of timeouts and proxy management stuff that's associated with it. And pages that you pull down will have last modified dates and how long they should stay in the cache and stuff. So that's a way of reducing the bandwidth for an ISP in the sense that they can proxy cache stuff locally at the ISP. Now turn that picture around. Put the cache between the web server and the outside world. A request comes into the web server asking for a specific page. That specific page might need quite a bit of processing power to generate. So what we do is we generate it, we let the request go through, we generate that page, but then we cache it at the edge of our web server, basically. So when the next request comes in for that exact same page, we don't need to run this resource, this CPU-intensive thing that might do database queries and all kinds of stuff. We cache the result at the top level there. And we can then tell it, please cache this information for 10 seconds. The other problem that it solves is when you run PHP inside of Apache, PHP is going to be running as the web server or as the web user ID. The same user ID that the web server runs as is what your PHP script will execute as. And there's no real way around that. We can't switch users at the beginning of the request and then switch back at the end of the request. It simply doesn't work. There is a tentative solution in Apache 2 called the per-child. This per-child mechanism, or NPM it's called, really doesn't work at all. So we had hopes at some point that this would solve the problem, but it doesn't really. This is really the best solution. Put a reverse proxy out in front of your web server, and then put each individual user's PHP script in his own instance of Apache. So what I'm trying to solve here is that on an ISP, on a shared web host, where you have multiple people all writing PHP scripts and they don't trust each other, you don't want Joe to be able to read Bob's files. The way to get around that, put a front-end proxy cache on it, have multiple instances of Apache running on different ports. And when the request comes in for a certain user's web page, you have a little redirector of some kind. You can script these front-end caches, and you can say, anything coming in for this particular domain, route it to port 80. Anything from that domain, route it to port 81. The outside world doesn't see the port numbers because these are the only localhost port numbers. They will still get served out on port 80 from the proxy. So that's the other class of problem that this solves. Putting a proxy in front of PHP really doesn't affect you in any way. The only thing that might break is this remote address variable. This is something set by the web server that's telling you where did the request come from. As far as the web server is concerned, the request came from the proxy. It didn't come from the end user. The proxy does forward this information to you in a variable called HTTP X forwarded 4. So if you were using a remote address, you probably need to replace that with a forwarded 4 instead. What I'm really getting to, though, is this next slide. This one is mostly for the notes. If you look at the PDF, you can see this configuration I'm going through and explaining how you actually configure Squid to be a reverse proxy cache. And the real trick is you set this HTTP acceleration host, and you tell it where it should go and what port it should send requests through to. Everything else is just sort of nice, but not necessary. Turning on SNMP so you can manage your proxy via SNMP and things like that. Now, what I'm really getting at is this architecture. This architecture is used all over the place these days, including Yahoo. Any large website out there has something like this behind it. You have some kind of request redirector. It may not cache. It may just be a redirector. You can buy hardware solutions that will go in and redirect web requests and sort of load balance them across multiple servers. In the middle, you have all your web servers. And behind the scenes, you have some kind of database server. Now, the idea is to replicate your data from your database onto each of your web servers so that every request that comes in is going to hit a PHP script running on that particular web server that's going to hit your database sitting on that particular host, which makes this infinitely scalable. The only bottlenecks will be your redirector, and you could even put sort of a tree of redirectors that will load balance across redirectors, for example. You could do some round-robin DNS to multiple redirectors if you wanted to. At this level, there's nothing really shared. Each single web server, sort of a standalone server that can serve up everything, from a read perspective, it doesn't need to touch this server, because all of these little MySQL slaves are a complete replica of the master. If they do need to write something, obviously they have to write to the master database server, and then it has to replicate out to everything else. So if your application is a write-heavy application, then this won't work. Most web applications are read-heavy on the back end. Think of a news site, right? You might add a story once a minute, but that same story is going to get hit 1,000 times a second, perhaps. So there's a huge discrepancy between reads and writes in most web situations, and this sort of architecture fits really, really well into something like this. And it's trivial to set up. I can't go through the whole thing, but you can read through it. But basically what you do is you turn on this thing called binary logging, the MySQLD, and you set a server ID. These are only basically the two things you need to do on your master database server. Turn on binary logging, give it a server ID. I usually call the master number one. Grant file on. Basically, this is creating a username and a password for the slave to use to log in. So anybody can't just connect to your master and replicate your database. So you set a username and a password. This is how you do it in MySQL 3. In 4.02 or later, you should use replication slave. So grant replication slave on dot to blah blah blah. Now on your slave servers, I tend to up my max connections first of all, because these are read-only servers. You can usually read a little bit faster than you can insert. I tend also to turn on binary logging. You don't really need it, but this means that any one of my slaves can become a master instantly. And there's actually a switch master query that you can send to MySQL that will switch masters. So if you need to do some work on your master server, you can switch it temporarily to one of your slaves that has a complete copy of your data, work on your master server, and then switch back and bring it back up. Define where the master is, the IP, the username, the password, the port, and you give it a unique server ID. Each MySQL server in this architecture has to have a unique ID. You can do a few other things. You can skip BDB and low priority updates, and there are a couple of switches you can toss in there to tune these servers to be read-only servers. Of course, the final thing you have to do is you have to write your application such that it reads from one database, but it writes to another. So whenever a query comes in that requires a write, you have to make sure you write to the master and don't try to write to your slave. Because if you write to your slave, that information is only going to be sitting on the slave, and it's basically going to be lost. How does it work if you change the master? So when the write goes to the master, basically, instantly, not quite instantly, obviously, but very, very fast, that same write goes out to the other slaves. Yes. Right. So, I mean, this switch master thing that you can do at the MySQL level, you're going to have something at the application level as well, that says, hey, application, now we have a new master somewhere else. And it may be easier just to maybe do an IP trick instead of doing that. But it's interesting in the sense that having the entire binary log on each of these other ones, if something drastic does happen to this master server, then all of these other guys have a log of what's happened. So if one of your slaves goes down, what happens is a slave goes down, that's fine, you're load balancer is going to take it out of the rotation. It might be down for a day. You bring it back up, and it's going to request all the transactions that happen. So it's going to get the binary log, right? So it catches up on its own. If for some reason your master server burns down in the middle of this, you have that binary log anywhere else. So an out of sync slave can then basically sync itself with another slave next to it, which is interesting. Yes. All right, enough about MySQL. This is another repeat slide that I've done. I took it out of my talk for a while, but people kept asking for it back in. One of my huge pet peeves is ugly URLs. URLs are too bloody long, they're too bloody ugly. They're not deterministic in the sense that you can sort of guess where things are on the website. You always have to go to the main page and start clicking. And most people don't seem to care. Most people think that's okay. I tend to like just being able to guess where something might be on the website. And also, if you're emailing a URL to somebody, it's nice that it doesn't wrap lines, right? I mean, if you're talking on the phone with your mother telling go to this website, you don't want to be there for 5 minutes negotiating that URL and getting all the slashes and question marks and stuff right. So, path info is the solution to all these problems. A very simple thing you can do with PHP and path info is you can have a URL like this, company.com/product/routers. Now, to anybody out there who are sort of in this mistaken belief that a URL is a remote file name, will think that, well, there must be a directory called products, and in that directory there must be something called routers, and it doesn't have an extension, so it's probably another directory. So we're probably sort of two directories deep. Actually, what we have is a file in our document root called products. It's not a directory, it's just a file. We've configured Apache to treat this file as a PHP script. So we do a force type on /products to be a PHP MIME type. So when this request comes in, Apache goes, stop right here. I know that /products is a PHP script, and it's going to try to open up that file and run it as a PHP script. So you have to have a file there named products, no .php or anything on it. And then in that file, you write a PHP script that looks at path info, $pathinfo. $pathinfo is going to have /routers in it. Drop the leading slash, and then do something intelligent with that string, like select star from your database of products where name like routers, right? So get a list of all the products that you have that talk about routers. A very simple little thing, but it's a clean URL and works for just about anything. So any product that people are searching for, it should give you something understandable back. Now we can take this and combine it with error document, and you'll see that on the PHP site, for example. If you go to MySQL Connect. Do that one. So go to PHP.net. Oh, I should have gone to the Australian. Look at that. It automatically redirected us to the Australian mirror because it knows I'm in Australia. And it automatically took me to the documentation page for MySQL Connect. We don't have a MySQL Connect file with this content in the document root of that server. We just have an intelligent error document handler. That's the error document handler is the Apache thing that runs when something goes wrong. And you can configure it. So you can say, on a 404 error, hopefully we all know what a 404 error is, run this script. In this case, error.php that sits in my document root. In error.php, I can then look at various variables, and one of the things I can find is in redirect URL, I will have the original URL. In my case, on my example there, it'll be /MySQL Connect. Drop the leading slash, go look in the database for anything called MySQL Connect to figure out where that data lives and serve it up. And then make sure you also send back a 200. Make sure you then say, hey, this is not a 404 anymore. This is actually the content itself. You may want to still have it a 404. You may say, hey, this is not the right place for it. Check here, 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 and here. And still make it a 404 page so that search engines don't store these URLs as the correct URLs. On the PHP case, we don't really mind. We like these short URLs. We don't mind search engines saying, hey, this is the right place for this, because this really is the right place for these things. It happens to be in a different place on the server itself, but this is sort of how you get to it. This is the API for our web application is the URL. And that's always what I try to teach people, is that it really is the API. There's very little user-visible API for a normal web application. How you get to the application, how you send it stuff, it's either clicking buttons and filling in forms, or it's also the URL. Anything that has to do with location of stuff should be in the URL. meaning in the part before any question mark. It'd be nice to not have any question marks at all, but some are good. I mean, some that are optional things, they're okay after the question mark. But things that have to do with anything about layout and where things are, templates, all kinds of stuff like that should be in the first part of your URL. Anyway, other things we can do with this. Remember my generated images before? Sometimes if you're generating the same image over and over again, it doesn't make much sense to run all this code that's CPU intensive to generate an image, especially if that image is going to be the same for a specific URL all the time. So here I have an image generator 404 handler. Basically what this does, it goes through the path info and picks out some things. So my URL might look something like this: localhost images button test 000 png. So I have coded in some things into my file name, button underscore test underscore 000 dot png. So I have four things: the name of the type of image I want, the content of the image, the string test, the colors, in this case black, my text is black, and the fact that I want a PNG image. And that's what my little error handler picks out. I pick out these various components of the file name, break them out into variables, and then I just have a little bit of logic that goes through and says, okay, if we're asking for a JPEG, send them a JPEG. If they're asking for a PNG or a GIF, send them a PNG because I don't do GIF. If they're asking for a button, draw a button, right? So this is generated dynamically based on the file name. But the real trick to this is right here. I do two things. I save that generated image to the destination file. The destination file is the file name that they asked for. Then I serve up the image. Now, if you think of it, the next request that comes in for that exact same file name, it's going to be there. You're not going to get a 404 error. This script will not execute the second time, right? It's going to go directly to the file system and serve up that static image. Now, if you change something about your image generation, then to sort of dump your cache, all you have to do is remove all your files. So just erase all your image files, then the first request for a certain image is going to generate that image. I used this for a large weather site once, where they generate weather maps for various cities and sort of very nice things with sunshine and clouds and stuff for the next 5 days or whatever. And they had tons and tons of cities that came in all the time, and they were previously running a script that would generate all these images. But only about 5% of these images were ever seen before the next update, 6 hours later, where they have new weather information. So instead of generating all the images in every single request, and instead of only generating them on demand, because something like New York gets hit 10 times a second, right? What we did was put this in and say, okay, only on the first request we generate, then we cache from then on. Every 6 hours, we just delete them all, and the system just sort of runs and runs. And you can take that further beyond images. You can take it to anything. I've also done a site in the past that had no documents. All it had was an error handler. And I mean, the URLs and everything all sort of flowed together. It looked like a normal site because you click on the URL, it goes to the next page, it goes here and there, and you see different file names, you see different things. But all it was a big ass error handler that had all these various sort of conditions of where the next click should go and stuff. And I would look at the URL and would determine which information to show based on that URL. And there's really nobody that says that data has to have a one-to-one relationship with a file name specified by a URL. Most people happen to work that way, but you don't have to do it that way. And I mean, the single error handler is probably going too far. You really should cache some of this information, and you really should have some stuff that is not done up by an error handler. But for maybe a part of your website, it's not a bad idea. And the way you can do it something like this. We have this thing called output buffering in PHP. You start it by saying OB start, then any output after you start output buffering is going to get stuck in memory. When you're then done, so you generate whatever content, you might do some SQL queries, you generate basically the bulk of your page, then you can do a get contents that fetches everything you've generated so far, all the HTML, everything that came out of that is now in this data variable. I can then save that data to the place that they asked for it and close it, and flush, flushes the contents of the buffer out. So it also sends it out, but it has also written it to the location that they asked for. So for example, ibm.com/thinkpad/cpu/t20. If I went to that URL, I have given IBM three very distinct keywords. I said, ThinkPad CPU T20. Why shouldn't they show me information about the CPU in a ThinkPad T20 if I sent them that? Why should they show me an ugly error page? I gave them three keywords, just do it. Now, if the next guy comes along and says, IBM.com T20 CPU ThinkPad, in a different order, that makes no difference. I mean, if you search on a search engine, it doesn't really matter what order your keywords are in. You still get the same results. Why should it matter what order a couple of keywords in your URL are in, right? So in that sense, something like this can go and fetch the right information. You pick out those three keywords out of the path info. You do your database searches, whatever, and you write that information to that spot. That means that the same information might be written in many different places. But who cares? Disk is cheap. So you have to be somewhat intelligent about it, because once you want to refresh your cache, you have to go and find all these files that were created. So you have to have some control and only do it in a certain part of your website, so you can then delete that entire section. But it's interesting in the sense that why should you decide where things go? You're the one writing the website. It's not for you, you're writing it. You're writing it for customers. You're writing it for other people. If 90% of the people visiting your website think that the content should be over here, then it should be over there. You can't really argue with that. And in this sort of way, the website will mend itself, and it will put things where people want it to be. You may not necessarily know where anything is after a while, but it doesn't matter. What you're controlling is the back-end data source. What the users are controlling is where they find it. All right. Maybe some questions so far on that stuff? Usually people sort of go, yeah. In terms of your, okay, you mean the error handler? Yeah, there are many ways of actually doing a bit more interesting things. You could use mod rewrite, for example, long before it gets to PHP. You can use mod rewrite to rewrite the URLs to something else. So you can have sort of a whole list of different PHP scripts that can be run. Well, you're going to have to depend on the web server to begin with. Error document is an Apache directive, right? Right, but I mean that now becomes a feature of the of Tomcat probably, or whatever you're using there. I mean, that's a feature of that particular web server. Well, no. Yeah, okay, but it's the same feature. You're relying on that certain feature. The fact that there aren't other implementations that do anything different is just that the fact that there's only one. There are many different web servers out there. PHP is not a web server, right? So we can't do web server things like mapping URLs at the PHP level, because all we're doing, we're a content generator. So I mean, it's sort of you're asking PHP to do something that it cannot possibly do, with the exception of the fact that I've written something called the Apache hooks SAPI, which is actually a way that PHP can hook into all kinds of different request layers of Apache, and I can basically write an Apache module with PHP. In that sense, I could do it all in PHP. I could put a URI translation hook into Apache written in PHP, and in that hook, I could do the rewrite from that request to something else. But this also becomes very Apache specific in the sense that PHP now just has to hook into the right place in Apache. There is no way that PHP itself can sort of be the global receiver of requests and do its own dispatching at that point, because that's simply not what it does. That's what the web server does, right? Set aside. Of course, no, you can do an include. I mean, you can have a big switch and you say, okay, if this is there, then okay, include that file. Sure, you can do that. But I mean, it's still one big file that then sort of can then cascade down into others. Definitely you can do that, but that's sort of a very brain dead approach to it. I was looking for a cooler approach. No, yeah, that's really stupid. Yes. PHP can talk to sockets. Yes, you can write a web server in PHP if you want, but don't, damn it. Yeah. Yes, it's a two parse. The question was, this is the two-stage parser, basically, yeah. Yeah, you are probably three slides away or something. I'm going to talk about that after the break. You can do recursive includes if you like. I will go through. I have a picture of that whole stage, and I'll explain it better. Yes. Yeah, there is. Yeah, I know there's a web server in PHP. There's also an IRCD written in PHP. There is a SendMail clone written in PHP. There's all kinds of brain dead stuff out there. That doesn't mean it's a good idea just because somebody did it. Other questions? So the question is, do I put PHP GTK in the category of just because someone did it? in a certain sense, yes. PHP GTK is great for certain things. I would not use PHP GTK to write client-side applications sort of in general, right? PHP GTK, for those who don't know, is basically the GTK API ported to PHP or have an extension in PHP so you can access GTK directly from PHP. So you can write client-side applications both for Windows and for Unix in PHP. It sort of works. It's not bad. You can use Glade to generate the XML file that then turns into a GTK app. So it's a very fast way of prototyping a user interface and actually having it work. And if you already have existing PHP code on the back end, it's probably a good way. Say, for example, you are, I don't know, maybe a travel company, and you have a very nice website where people can go through and book tickets and stuff, but you are somewhat limited by what you can do in HTML. So for the occasional person who visits your site once a year to book a trip, it's fine that they have to click a few times. But your salespeople that sit there 8 hours a day managing the same information, if they have to use the same interface, they'd probably go nuts. With PHP GTK, you can take the same back-end routines that are used for your website, and you can write a slick client-side GUI application that hooks into exactly the same code. So if you fix something in the code, you don't have to go and fix your GUI application because it's using the same back-end stuff. You have the includes that include the same .php files in behind the scenes for both the web and for the desktop application. So in that sense, no, PHP GTK is useful. Hell of a lot more useful than a web server written in PHP. We're almost at break time. One more question before the break? Okay, let me tell you what's happening after the break so you can bail if you want to. Where are we? We're here. We're going to talk about... Remember I promised I would talk about how to actually architect your large-scale application, what should go where. We'll talk about security. Then I'll talk about some of the cool new things in PHP 5, various OO features and streams, filters, some nasty stuff, PHP awk. SQLite, simple XML, those things are both really cool. And then a section on performance, opcode caches. That's where we come in and talk about sort of how the two-stage parser works with the opcode generator and executor and things like that. tuning, benchmarking, how to optimize your PHP code, what things you can do wrong to make PHP code run really slow, and some very easy things you can go home and do to your own stuff to make it go much faster right away. So that's for the second section. See you in half an hour.